Therefore, in our fairy tale, we nearly always visualize our own psychic integration as being under the heavy pressure of a negative or evil force. The individual is quite convinced of many things in this life, and among these things is the belief that he is in some way at a disadvantage, that the work he is doing is not the work that he is suited for, that the estimation of other people about him is not correct. He is misunderstood, he is undervalued, he is overworked, and he is just plain victim. Now, this goes for nearly everyone in some level of thinking. Even those who try to hold a strong psychic idealistic imagery believe that they are in some way victims of injustice. Man is the eternal victim. He is always in a position of disadvantage. This goes back to the primitive fact that man is unable to estimate the true relation of the world in which he lives, unable to dominate the vast environmental forces around him, always regards himself with a profound streak of inferiority. Even a superiority complex is merely a desperate defense against personal insecurity. So the individual cannot but feel within himself that providence, fate, accident, incident, circumstance, that these things are working against him to produce a common disaster, and that this disaster itself is a word which means evil star, disaster, and simply indicates that he was born at the wrong time and under unfavorable conditions. Out of all of this, we also, of course, realize the human being's inevitable determination not to admit responsibility for these things. He cannot assume completely the burden of self-directive. One of the reasons that he takes this attitude is also subconscious. Namely, the individual does not feel that he should be held responsible for situations which he does not understand and about which he does not seem to possess the power of direction or control. Under these circumstances, it is evident that his condition remains impossible or comparatively helpless without intervention or without intercession. And here in the fairy story comes the power of the miracle to break the pattern of human expectancy. There is no way in which this thing, these problems, can be solved on a level. The only way in which they can be solved is by the introduction of some kind of a miraculous or a causal factor. The individual must be saved from this dilemma. He cannot save himself. He is helpless. Like poor little Cinderella, he has nowhere to turn. No one loves him anymore. And he is under the tyranny of a cruel stepmother and her ambitious daughters. The soul cannot break this bondage. Something must happen to redeem it, release it, give it opportunity, and to break this pattern. And in a way to prove what the individual affirms, namely, that his own psychic life as Cinderella is a noble life, a pure life, a beautiful life. There's nothing wrong with it. It is the victim of other people. And in order to be released, something has to happen. And the individual does not know how it is going to happen or what is going to happen. And in this emergency, which, like Mark Twain's famous unfinished story, never seems to come to an end, the only power that man has conceived of is divine intercession. Through prayer, through contrition, through patience, through the practice of the virtues, through being continuously good, though continually afflicted, the individual earns or merits a better destiny. And this destiny must come, or else the entire system of idealism involved in the fairy story is a snare and an illusion. There is also this problem that we cannot completely ignore, namely that man's faith in the happy ending must have some ground. If man believed that things would come out well, was never fulfilled, or fulfilled so rarely and so scarcely that it made no pattern in society, your good ending fairy story could not survive. So we come to another dimension that is frequently overlooked, and that is that the individual who can actually and fairly and honestly affirm that he has lived like the hero or heroine of the fairy story, been good to those that despitefully used him, forgiven his enemies, been patient under adversity, and most of all remained indomitable in hope, certain in faith, and persistent in charity, to that individual some good ending must come. Well, these procedures may be universal, but the good ending is always individual. And the majority of persons who have lived by these codes have found a good ending, and that is why the story lives. Now, this good ending is private, personal. It may never find a place in history. It does not involve great changes in society. But it does mean that this individual has lived a constructive life and died with a good hope. And this preserves or keeps the pattern of the fairy story intact. Exceptions, therefore, when examined, nearly always indicate that the leading character was not as much of a hero or a heroine as the situation required. So the happy ending lives because persons have seen it, have known it, not as vast social motions, but as private conduct leading to the simple and natural admiration of neighbors and associates, strengthening family ties, and gradually bringing this person into a reasonable degree of security. And wherever this security is not present, the factors necessary for the happy ending have not been duly practiced. Now, we may say that such due practice involves other people, and we would love to hope that it does. And in many cases, it may. But the happy ending depends primarily upon the power of the good fairy or magic within ourselves. The happy ending is best assured and most directly contrived by the individual continuing to practice the power that is given to him by this fairy spirit within himself that has the power of transforming and transmuting adversity through constructive mental emotional interpretation. And when we get all these factors together, we find that the person who has kept a happy spirit will have available to them this tremendous, needed, creative imagery. And if it has been lost, it can be regained. And by regaining it, we restore the desired state of affairs. In the anima image, we have, of course, the feminine polarization of man's psychic life. And somewhere in the background of things, we have to realize that the androgene psychic nature must be reconciled, must be brought together and restored or reunited. One of the points that is made in fairy stories by moderns, who have sometimes even attempted to rewrite them, is that the story ends too soon. The story should not have ended when the princess found her handsome prince, It should have gone on for a few more years to the domestic squabble and the final breakup. Then it would have been factual. We don't like to assume that after this wonderful romantic episode, anything could follow different from our own too frequent experience. Yet in almost every instance, the fairy story ends at this point. Some say that is why it is a fairy story. But again, humanity was not without its recognition of values. Man knew long ago that the course of life does not run smoothly. And had it served any essential purpose in his psychic life, the story would have been continued. But from the level of his purpose, it did not mean anything that it should continue. Because the thing that was being emphasized was not the perpetuation of society. The thing that was being emphasized was the ultimate union of the anima animus, or the polarized soul power of man. And once that is united, there can be no divorce and no unhappy ending. Because all unhappy endings here are due to the disunity of these factors. Once they are brought together, conflict, which is the source of man's difficulty, is removed. If, however, they are allowed to remain polarized, they result in conflict and what we call the conflict of personalities around us and in our relations with others. This conflict is essentially motivated and sustained by the psychic conflict of divided parts within ourselves. As long as these parts are in a condition of conflict, of contrast, and to a certain degree of psychic competition, we will have the same situation in society. And it is the inability of the individual to get together with himself that ultimately makes it impossible for him to get together with anybody else. The psychic life is the problem. And the story need go no further, because there is nothing beyond the final union of the two polarities of the soul. That is, so far as folklore is concerned. For it is always this reunion of divided parts, this bringing into harmonious relation the elements that cause conflict. Now, these elements cannot be harmonized by any energy, by any will, by any purpose that is artificial. They can be divided by pressure, but they cannot be united by pressure. They can be brought into conflict by error, but they cannot be united by error. Therefore, all negative factors divide them. All positive factors unite them. And it is only when, through the natural development of the human consciousness, that these polarizations are reconciled, that the individual can look forward to an internal integration that is adequate and permanent. The whole story, of course, practically all of our folklore, has descended through such media as the Roman fable of Cupid and Psyche, in which the polarities of the soul are indicated, and by which much of our modern psychological thinking is motivated today. So now we have a situation that is universal. We have poor little Cinderella, who is suffering from the tyrannies of an evil stepmother. The stepmother is not essentially evil in any way in which you can literally put your finger on it. She is simply self-centered and concerned with the advantages for her own children. The stepmother then becomes a symbol of many things. Perhaps it is a form of the so-called foster mother, not the true mother, because the true mother is an image. The true mother is a psychic image within the being, and the true mother must be benevolent. Consequently, let us assume now that there is a conflict between the mother image in the human soul and the parent mother on earth. Because the psychic integration of the human being will not permit the complete acceptance of the material mother. The material mother is always a kind of foster parent, because the soul does not actually believe that it has its complete origin in the parent. A very large number of children claim throughout life, and upon psychological conditioning later, reaffirm that they were locked from infancy, that they were never able to get through to parent, although they might have desperately wished to do so. One of the intervals, of course, is age interval. It is impossible for the parent to share any longer the vital problem of the small child. It must look down upon this problem, look back upon it, or reinterpret it in terms of more mature living of its own. This forms no bridge between the parent and the child, and is perhaps one of the reasons why it has been proven that early marriages and early children have a little better chance, because the parent has not yet become so completely removed from its own childhood. In any event, we have either the symbol of the stepmother, or we have the symbol of the child who is unable to get through to the world around it, to its environment, to any other thing but itself. And in psychological interpretation or imagery, the step-parent becomes symbolic of the unreceptive person that is close to the child, the one who does not understand, the one who does not help or cooperate or appreciate, the one who criticizes unjustly, punishes unfairly, and is not available in emergency or need. Such a person breaks with the mother image. The nagging parent breaks with the mother image, can no longer be regarded or accepted as the mother image, is separated definitely from it by the internal working of consciousness, and becomes a kind of step-parent, becomes a false mother or an unreal mother. And the child, where this lack of closeness develops, prefers to build a mother image within itself by magic. And this mother image then becomes symbolical of the true parent, and becomes the measure of the other parent, usually an unfavorable scale of measurement. Where, of course, the parent has been appropriate, has met the need, has been reasonable, and has created confidence between itself and the child, the stepmother image does not arise. The stepmother image does not mean a literal step-parent. It means a parent whose primary concern is not for the child. It means the parent who has the other children, and these other children are other interests, whatever they may be. It means that the parent has a career which keeps it from the child, that the parent has other obligations which keep it from the child. Very seldom, however, does the child react badly if these obligations are necessary, any more than the child reacts badly to merited punishment. When a child knows that it deserves punishment, its psychic nature is not injured by rebuke, if that rebuke is reasonable. It is only when the child honestly and sincerely believes that an injustice has been committed that trouble starts. It's the same way in connection with the step sisters, who represent parental interests that separate the child from parent. And against these, jealousies arise, and these become symbolic of enemies, of adversities, of adversaries, of all kinds. They are whatever it is that will keep the parent from the child. Under some conditions, these stepchildren may also be other children in the family where the parent has shown unreasonable favoritism against the child who has the highly colored imagination. Seeking for redress, comparing the world with the image, the child says, "This cannot be my parent, because this does not fulfill the parent image, which is born with the child, and which is part of the child's own internal consciousness." Thus we find Cinderella brought down into a rather mediocre situation of simply being a servant of the stepmother and the stepsisters. A servant now means mediocre association. It means that the child is sacrificed or bound or chained to the purposes of other people. And wherever the psychic integration recognizes, therefore, that it is imposed upon, that it is exploited, that it is sacrificed to other purposes, the identity of family, the unity of the relationship between the child and parent, these things are disrupted. In this emergency, the child does what all children do. Cinderella retires into herself and into an imaginary world. This is her world of magic. And this is the way in which the soul attempts to compensate for the troubles with which it is burdened. Again, the story, as we said, belongs to a period or a level of idealism in society, in a time when retiring into self was not an experience of frustration alone, but an experience of re-identification with divine good. Primitive man, even, after he escaped from the first pressures of fear, began to sense in internalization a valuable procedure, a procedure which gave him internal contact with that which is superior to material things, the mystical union, the identification of the person with the source of its own spiritual strength and life. This would be the attitude which we find in the Cinderella story. We find the psychic entity, in this case the anima, searching for new outlets and finding them through introspection, through the recreation of its own internal sense of values, the building of an inner life. Now, of course, actually, all of the purposes of our outer training are that we shall build an inner life. The reason why the pressures around us become incessant and continually more aggressive is because they are challenging internal resource. The average person, not accepting this challenge, throws it back upon society and becomes profoundly disturbed. Actually, our entire material existence has as its end and goal the recognition that it is not the end and goal, and that through man's inability to overwhelm the collective material state, he must come to the realization that his growth, his maturity, his peace of mind, these things lie within himself. So the psychic life, recognizing the frustration which can be worldliness in all of its forms and departments, the competition, ambition, greed, and selfishness of everything around it, personified by the step-parent and the daughters. This psychic life, as in the more historical account of St. Francis of Assisi, turns inward to begin the development of an internal world of beauty. This internal world of beauty must lead to the gradual unfoldment of the great romance of the soul. The romance which leads to the hermetic union or the identification of the parts of the soul in total relationship. To achieve this end, magic has to be brought into the story, because this magic is the magic of internal visualization. Under magic also would come all of your mystical disciplines, all of your meditative practices, all of your Eastern yoga and Vedanta, all of your Western mysticism and your idealistic religious emotion teaching. All of these things would fall under the same general heading. They represent the ladder by which the individual seeks to ascend into total identity with himself. The soul, discovering that it will not be understood in the world, turns to seek the understanding of its own counterpart, seeks to be united with the only thing with which it can ever be actually united. And if the soul's making this journey, it represents the anima, then the end, the goal, must be the animus, or its union with the positive pole of itself. Here we have a statement that is theologically quite obvious, for we find it again, of course, in the Apocalypse of St. John, where the entire fairy story lives again, now on the level of high religious legendary. Here we have the holy city of Jerusalem adorned as a bride, and we find the church representing the spiritual ecclesia or assembly of man being raised up into marriage with the Lamb, symbolizing the messianic power of the Oversoul. Thus the search for union with the divine part or the overpart of self, the search for the ultimate satisfaction of all need, the end of all incompleteness, lures the soul to the next of its most magical practices. And in this case, it is represented by this wonderful palace in which lives the young prince, who is always conveniently unattached. He is never in a position which is going to triangulate anything, which is, of course, always helpful in the fairy story, but must be true in the case of the soul, because actually the soul, anima, animus, are soul mates, because not that they are embodied in different persons who must find each other, but upon different levels which must be united in one being. So the prince gives his wonderful ball at the palace, which is, of course, the symbolism of a high dramatic ritual, a romantic ritual, a symbol of all of the ideals which would be represented by the young and frustrated girl, Cinderella. By the aid of the magician, the magic of the good fairy, she is able to attend this tremendous festival in the palace of the prince. This part of the legend, like many other elements of it, is derived directly from the high religious mysticism of the troubadours. The young prince and his gay court must be the court of love of the troubadours. It is here that all worldly things are transformed and transmuted into the rich pageantry of the world's highest romance. Here is a world of romantic wonder. Here is a world of unspeakable glory and richness. Yet it is not a material situation at all, any more than was the troubadour's court of love, or the languishing love songs of the Muslim dervishes and druzes and various religious sects. These things represent an allegory. In all cases, the beloved representing that part of the soul which must yet be attained. Now, the imagination of the individual may permit or make possible this temporary elevation of the consciousness to participation in the mystery of the soul drama. This is your ecstasy of religion. This is your mystical experience, carried in a pumpkin coach that has no real existence, limited by time, must be back before the midnight hour or the whole illusion vanishes. This entire situation represents the story of man's internal imagery leading him to temporary identity or to temporary experience of the presence of this divine state. This is then the extension of consciousness described by the sage and the saint and the seer. The time when he is lifted up for the moment into the glorious mystery of God, or the glorious mystery of happiness, of peace, of love, of faith, of serenity, and of beauty. As a result of the peculiar pact of magic itself, however, imagination cannot accomplish the final end. And we have another interesting simile brought in, and that, of course, is the glass slipper. In departing in haste from this ceremonial experience, Cinderella leaves behind her an identifying object, something that pertains and belongs only to her, and which cannot be made to fit into any other person or being in the world. By this means, by this circumstance, the ultimate discovery of Cinderella by the prince will be achieved. Now here we come again to another phase of the religious fable, which we might always bear in mind. In this type of story, we have two factors working one against the other, or in a certain sense, in sympathy. One is the ascending need of the soul itself, which is represented by Cinderella and her magical experience. But man, according to the ancient wisdom teaching, not only must reach a point of saving himself, but he must also receive, according to the Christian dispensation, a certain saving grace, a certain power. He must not only perform certain actions, but heaven must move to meet him. Therefore, even in the Chinese, there's the saying, when man moves, heaven moves. So that the two polarities work with each other. It is not possible for the princess now, or Cinderella, to advance her own cause beyond a certain point. She has the mystical experience, meets the prince, becomes aware of his existence, and then must leave, going back again to the Latin story of Cupid and Psyche. Now it becomes the prince who can no longer live without the princess. Therefore, we have the positive or animus power of the soul moving into objectivity. We find, therefore, that this union must be achieved as the result of a powerful action on the part of the animus also. So it is now dependent upon the positive pole of the soul to search through the psychic integration and discover the true counterpart of itself in the psycho-emotional field of man. Thus, by using the slipper, which simply becomes like the golden bough of Virgil, the symbol of identification, how to discover or recognize, the positive power of the soul must also go forth to meet the negative and to discover the mysterious lost princess in the humble situation of Cinderella. It must therefore again emphasize the humility of mysticism, the simple naturalness of the human relationships in life, and that the divine in man is also searching for its own humanity. That the spiritual energy of the animus desires union with the anima once it has discovered its nature. Once it has experienced it, it draws upon itself the powers of the soul. It therefore goes forth as a positive agent seeking its own soul. Thus we have in man now a double personality problem. We have man instinctively, as Cinderella, dreaming of release, not daring to hope for what was going to happen, but by magic being brought into this magnificent circumstance. Then we have the positive polarity of the soul as consciousness, now rededicated to the conscious discovery and final union of itself with its own psychic polarity. Thus we have the two great purposes which dominate life. First, the ascent of man as a personality toward principle. And secondly, the descent of eternal principle within man toward union with objectivity. Thus occurring in the actual creation of the total soul, which is the union of ascending experience with descending illumination. The final union, therefore, takes place when the mortal being rising up provides means for the release or expression of the divine being through itself, and these meeting in a middle distance result in the hermetic marriage or the final union of the soul as psychic integration. Thus, in the middle ground between spirit and matter, between Cinderella and the prince, the mysterious psychic union takes place, which proves or provides the ground for the forever after, living in peace and happiness. The forever after is almost identical then with the concept of the nirvana of India or the heaven state of Western man. It is the foreverness resulting from the final binding of all separate things, the final union of the psychic poles in man, the ascent of the mortal and the descent of the immortal into common union as psychic life. And to the Egyptian, the soul was the immortal mortal and the mortal immortal. It was the being between heaven and earth, the Greek hero. And the attainment of this level above that of ordinary mortality that was the essential search of the golden age of Greek learning. It was also the end of alchemy, the marriage of the sun and moon, the ultimate union of the internal resources of man, the descending divine power of wisdom and the ascending human power of experience, meeting as understanding, or meeting as total sufficiency. That this legend should exist and should travel through countless peoples is therefore obviously archetypal. Man will accept it as no less. In his insecurity, he is searching for security and postulates it always in a being that is secure, the over-self. His search, therefore, is for the oversoul of Emerson, the total psychic sufficiency. This is nearly always a prince or a king or a ruler or someone superbly wise, because it must always be the king of the self. It always represents the unquestioned authority of consciousness over all of its attributes and all of the conditions which it engenders. It is a ruler, because it is the only fit ruler of the self. It is always the administrator. And it is always as animus, wonderful, handsome, strong, the fulfillment of all desire, even as when it is anima, it is always the beautiful maiden who must be rescued. So our stories always relate either to the positive pole of consciousness rescuing the lesser, or the negative pole of consciousness through the virtue of its own patience, through its dedication, through its understanding, through the victory of faith over fear, gradually deserving the intercession of the spiritual power. The anima must deserve. The animus must be deserved, because it represents causal consciousness which must be earned. And that which earns it must fulfill its way the psychic nature represented by Cinderella must live the doctrine in order to know it. But that which lives the doctrine invokes it, and the psychic prince comes to the rescue of the individual who has kept its rules and obeyed its laws and deserved its presence. Thus the romance of the two parts of the soul becomes the only romance in which the human being as idealist can detect no flaw, can perceive no limitation, and cannot view with misgiving of any kind. It is that romance of which all material relations are symbolical. For it is through physical and human associations, rightly understood and rightly lived, that man becomes capable of these overtones of emotion and consciousness by which he can mature his own soul. Therefore, all physical relationships are symbolical of the divine relationships of the two parts of man's soul with the attendant members of the caste, all of the other factors, the mind, the ambition, the intuition, all these personified become the persons in the great psychic drama within man. But this drama is always a love story, for it always represents ultimately man's love for God and good and his ultimate resolution to attain union with the divine. Thus it becomes a great story in which man's fear of God or his respect for God gradually changes into his unqualified love of God and his resolve and determination to be worthy to be loved by God. These form the instinctive patterns of primitive people, and they have come down to us in the fairy tale and the legend, and their utility and their practical insight is as great today as it was long, long ago. And time is up, so that's it.